and remained still. The doctor said, "He's not awake, but he will be. Given his body mass, he should have been out for 24 hours. Any time now. The girl is a different story." The blonde said, "He's awake. He's fucking with us." Aaron felt a fist curl into his hair and his head jerked upright. He opened his eyes, knowing the subterfuge was done. The blonde said, "Everyone out of the room. Now." Aaron watched the scrum leave, remaining mute. The blonde turned to him and said, "My name is Johan, and I've been tasked to find out why you're following us. Look, I don't like getting rough. I honestly don't. Please make this easy on me. Just tell me what you're doing here and why." Aaron spoke the truth, knowing that Alex had probably given up everything she knew. "I was sent to prevent embarrassment to Israel. They are afraid of nefarious diamond dealing, afraid of a stain on the diamond exchange. That's all." Johan nodded, then said, "I wouldn't expect you to tell the truth right up front." "I'd believe you, except you happen to focus on me in Soweto, and I have nothing to do with the diamond exchange." He shook his head and said, "Too bad. You stepped into a world of shit." He let go of Aaron's head, saying, "I let your partner live if you just tell me how much Israel knows about our plans." Aaron said, "Where is Alexandra?" "She's here. I've already interrogated Alex. She's a nobody, clearly untrained. Someone duped by the State of Israel, and now regretting it. Her death will be on your hands." He turned and gave Aaron the full force of his gaze, an unsettling stab. Aaron realized he was looking into the eyes of a man who had killed many, many times. "But that's not the partner I'm talking about. I mean your real partner, the one in Israel. You tell me what you know, and I'll let her live." Aaron heard the words and for the first time felt a sliver of hope. Left unsaid was Aaron's fate, but that mattered little. Since the moment of his capture, Aaron knew there was no chance of the Mossad helping. No rescue was forthcoming, and it had weighed heavily on his psyche, most notably because he felt responsible for Alexandra. He was nothing but a contractor, hired precisely to prevent Mossad fingerprints on the operation in question. He was a piece of tissue the Mossad used to blow its nose, and once soiled, easy to toss aside. But his partner in Israel was something altogether different. She cared about him. And she was a force unlike any this man had ever confronted. Aaron said, "I have told you what I know, which is nothing. I have no idea what's going on here. I'm just a contractor hired by the Diamond Exchange to make sure their reputation is not sullied. That's all. Alexandra is even less. I brought her solely because of her knowledge of the exchange. Let her go. Leave us be. I won't tell anyone what's occurred. There is no reason whatsoever to involve my partner in Israel." Johan withdrew a set of knuckle rings, a small two-finger version of brass knuckles. With a sad expression on his face, the disgust of what he was forced to do apparently real, he said, "I'll know what you know soon enough. And you've just killed your partner. Our reach is long, and I must ensure our operation is contained." Aaron steeled himself, knowing he would have to trade in order to be rescued, and the currency in question was pain. He had to force them to hunt in Israel. The man in front of him had no idea of what he was threatening when he mentioned Aaron's partner. He thought he understood pain, understood death, and he probably did on an earthly plane. But Shoshana was made of something entirely different. She was a supernatural predator who caused fear even in Aaron. Going after her would guarantee a response, if he could remain alive long enough to see it. Shoshana would unleash her skills, only if she deemed the reason worthy. And unfortunately for these men, harming him would trigger a reaction unlike anything they had ever seen. Because he had the honor of being deemed worthy. 7. Shoshana kept her eyelids shut and rolled over, but she knew it was no use. She felt the light coming in through the window and succumbed to it. She opened her eyes. For a second she was disoriented, not recognizing the room, then she remembered. She was in a hotel in Haifa, by herself. For the first time in a long while, she had allowed herself to sleep until she rolled out of bed naturally. But she'd still awakened at the first light of dawn. She threw off her covers and padded to the dresser, reaching for her cell phone. There were no missed calls. That wasn't unusual, given the nature of their work. But last night she'd had a bad feeling, and not in a normal, ephemeral way that most people get. It was visceral, and she had learned long ago to trust in her instincts. She had a connection to the world around her that she couldn't explain, but she knew it existed, and it had saved her life on more than one occasion. This feeling was different, though, in that it was tinged with something else besides danger. Was it jealousy? Was that it? She had no way of knowing, because she'd never experienced that emotion in her entire life, until she'd seen Alexandra with Aaron. Shoshana's history, like much of the history of Israel, had been one of hardship. Her ancestors had fled Europe to escape the slaughter of the Holocaust, only to meet the same end at the hands of a new breed of killer. Her grandfather had been murdered in the Munich Olympics massacre, sacrificing his life in a futile attempt to stop the Black September terrorists. She had been told of his heroic acts from the moment she could understand Hebrew. And then, when she was only 10, her parents were blown apart by a Hamas suicide bomber. An only child, she had become an orphan with a mission. She had served her mandatory time in the IDF military, but wasn't satisfied. She'd gravitated to the Mossad and was invited to join, where she'd learned more things about killing than she'd ever learned about flying helicopters. The Mossad saw quickly that she held a talent for their world, and they used it until it warped her. And then she'd found Aaron. She'd been thrown onto his team by the command against the wishes of Aaron's teammates. Her last team had branded her a coward at best and a traitor at worst, solely because she wouldn't kill an innocent man, a Palestinian she'd been forced to sleep with to set him up for the hit. She'd seen something in him, and not in a trusting storybook way. She'd really seen something in his aura, something nobody else apparently could. And she'd learned she was cursed with a gift. Aaron had ignored the baggage and taken her on his team, when nobody else in Mossad would touch her, and she'd returned the favor by saving his life on an operation in Argentina mere weeks later, when nobody else would help. They had clicked. For the first time in her bloody existence, she had connected with another human being. It had taken time, to be sure, with her unable to even understand the difference between simple respect and love. But eventually, they had both reached it. She thought. She had seen Aaron look at Alexandra when he first met her for the mission brief, surprised at her attractiveness. It had infuriated and confused her. Her entire universe of sexual experience had been sleeping with targets she was marking for a kill. Until she'd met Aaron, she'd never made love, had never competed for a man in her entire life, had never even entertained the notion. And now she wondered if she was fighting for not only the man, but also the single human on earth who understood her. It had been disconcerting, and she wondered about the missing phone calls. Was it the mission, or something else? She looked at herself in the mirror, hoping to see what she knew wasn't there. and she was rewarded with exactly what her subconscious mind realized. She wasn't conventionally attractive, but she'd never cared about that before. She made no attempt to wear makeup and had the body of a 15-year-old boy. It was nothing but muscle and sinew, without womanly curves. No bust and no hips. Her shape couldn't compete with Alexandra's voluptuous assets, with the exception of her face. Thin and aquiline, it would have played well on the fashion runways of Milan, if only her body had decided to cooperate. But she understood none of that. The pretty girls of her youth were crowned beauty queens and hailed, but eventually faded to the background, making way for the next generation, as they all do with the onslaught of age. Shoshana had not. She became an elite killer, scaring even the ones who commanded her. She was an anomaly, unlike anything the Mossad had ever seen. She could penetrate any defense, using an uncanny ability to read the opposition, and could kill without remorse. She was the perfect weapon. Right up until she decided she no longer wanted to be a weapon. Looking in the mirror, she failed to see past the reflection to what Aaron saw, what connected them. She'd seen his reaction to Alexandra, and knew she wasn't even in the same league as her, and it made her question. Was the feeling last night because of that, or was it real? Was Aaron in danger, or was her relationship? She was startled by her phone vibrating, and she snatched it up, looking at the screen. She saw a gobbledygook number, something that was clearly masked, and felt dread. It was the Mossad. She answered in a hesitant voice. Hello? Hey, Carrie, it's Pike. I'm in town. She heard the stupid call sign the Americans had given her and suppressed a grin, her earlier angst forgotten. Pike Logan was the last person she expected to hear from, but exactly what she needed. He was all about the mission and would chastise her for her failing emotions. He aggravated her to no end, usually bringing her to the point of wanting to slice his carotid arteries just to get him to shut up. But she never did, because when she looked into his eyes and read his soul, she saw he was just as tortured as she was, and just as good at killing. Once upon a time, he had crawled out of the abyss, finding Jennifer and a new life. She wanted to do the same. What on earth are you doing calling me? Don't tell me you want a tax receipt for that last mission. I can't help it if you're in trouble with your IRS. She hadn't seen Jennifer and Pike since the wedding, and truth be told, she missed them, missed teasing Pike especially. He said, "Nah, it's nothing like that. We're in town helping out with some UNESCO work on that Caesarea site, and thought we could have dinner." Caesarea? Are you toying with me? Besides being a UNESCO World Heritage Site, Caesarea also happened to be the name of the section in the Mossad that conducted covert action, and was the organization that Shoshana had belonged to before she and Aaron went freelance. No, no, it's Caesarea for real. I was told not to even contact you, if you know what I mean. But I can't come to Tel Aviv without having a beer with you and Aaron. She knew exactly what he meant. He and his partner, Jennifer, owned a company called Gralia Recovery Services, which ostensibly did archaeological work around the world, but in reality allowed the United States to penetrate hostile states to put some threat into the ground. Mentioning Caesarea and saying he wasn't supposed to contact her told volumes. He was here on a mission, and it was outside the purview of the Mossad. And the fact that he had told her that, knowing she would connect the dots, spoke volumes as well. He trusted her. She didn't return the favor, giving a half-truth. "I like that, but you picked the worst week, dummy. We're up at the Dan Carmel in Haifa on a little vacation." The much-talked-about honeymoon? Aaron finally agreed? "Yes." Well, he agreed until the mission came down. Erin had already booked and paid for the hotel, and had planned on surprising her with the getaway. And he had. Only now, instead of a happy event, it had been an afterthought as he was headed out the door with Alexandra. She'd decided to come up on her own. Pike said, "Well, how far is Haifa? It can't be more than a couple of hours. How about we finish up here and meet you guys there?" Quicker than she wanted, she said, "No, no, we're committed up here. We have something planned every day." She wasn't sure if she was protecting the fact that Erin was active on a mission, or protecting herself from embarrassment when they found out she was up here alone. He said, "You have to eat, don't you? And Jennifer's dying to see Shoshana in married life. She's pretty sure you've killed Erin and stuffed him in a hole somewhere." Shoshana laughed and said, "Jennifer or you?" "Well, okay, me." "I figured. How long are you here for?" "Probably a week."
"Erin should be back before then."
"Okay. Let me talk to Erin. Give us a couple of days and maybe we can break free."
8. I hung up the phone just as Jennifer exited the bathroom, wearing a bathrobe and padding around barefoot, running a brush through her hair. She said,
"So, was she surprised?"
I said, "She was surprised." I glanced out the window of our hotel room, seeing the shoreline of Tel Aviv, but running through Shoshana's call. Jennifer stopped her brushing, saying,
"But?"
I turned back to her and said, "But it was strange. She was strange. She doesn't want to see us."
"What? Seriously?"
"Well, she's with Erin in Haifa, at some hotel called Dan Carmel. She didn't seem too interested in our visit." Jennifer perked up at that, saying,
"They're together at a hotel in Haifa? Is this the honeymoon?"
"That's what she said, but I don't know." Shoshana was one of the strangest women, hell, humans, I'd ever met. When we'd first collided, I tried to kill her, believing she was responsible for the death of one of my men. I had failed. Later on, we'd crossed paths again, and she'd proven to be one of the most lethal operators I've ever met. She manifested some sort of weird animal vibe, like a dog that growled when a rapist entered a room. She saw things in the soul and could penetrate a man's intentions just by being in his presence. Truth be told, it was a little scary. I poked fun at her on the surface, but I'd learned it was real. She'd had no social skills to speak of when we first met, and had taken what I considered an unhealthy interest in my relationship with Jennifer, as if she was learning how a man and woman interacted, almost like an alien life form. Erin suffered through it, coaxing her along, or so I'd thought. He was the yang to her yin, and they clicked no less than Jennifer and I, on some weird astral plane. Eventually, they'd left the Mossad and set up their own private security firm, but I was pretty sure all of their money still came from that intelligence agency. They'd married about 6 months ago in Jerusalem, and we'd been at the wedding, which, of course, since Shoshana was involved, turned into a damn fiasco. Jennifer had asked where they were taking their honeymoon, and Shoshana had latched on to that, having no idea such a thing existed. Erin had rolled his eyes, but Shoshana was insistent, and it looked like she'd finally convinced him, 6 months later. Jennifer said,
"Well, maybe it's better to leave them alone. We don't want to do a repeat of the wedding."
Which was an understatement. I said, "I'm with you," but something was off. She wasn't Shoshana. Jennifer threw a towel at me and said,
"Quit reading into things. Let them have their fun. We have a mission here."
I grinned and said, "Thank God Kurt broke Brett free. Otherwise, we'd never get any sleep." She went back into the bathroom saying,
"I'm not sure how he's helping us sleep."
I shouted, "What's that mean? I gave him the early shift." She poked her head out and said,
"Really? He gets the shift at 6 in the morning, and you still wake me up?"
"You didn't mind that at 6 a.m. She smiled and said,
"No, but it didn't add to my sleep."
I grinned and said, "We all have to sacrifice." She raised an eyebrow, but I knew she wasn't going to push it. She said,
"What's his status anyway?"
"Still in the lobby waiting." Our turnaround from Las Vegas had been immediate, with Knuckles and Retro heading back to D.C., and Jennifer and me flying straight out to Tel Aviv. Knuckles had tried to argue one more time, saying he could man the TOC or something else not involving surveillance, but Kurt had overridden that decision. We'd met Brett Thorpe at JFK, and, as expected, he was ready with a wry response after getting pulled from his liaison job. He'd held up his ticket and said, "Kurt told me to catch this flight. I asked why, and all he said was Pike Logan. I saw the location as Israel, heard your name, and knew they were punishing the black man." Brett was a short fireplug of a man, about 5'6" and solid muscle. He'd been a recon marine in a prior life, but had spent 10 years inside the CIA's Special Activities Division, before he was recruited to the task force. At first, I'd been extremely skeptical of him, because he was CIA, and we all belonged to tribes. But he'd proven himself on a mission in Lebanon, with both his skill and his sense of humor, and I'd moved heaven and earth to get him on my team. Kurt said I was stacking the deck, which of course was true, but he'd allowed it. Brett's comment was accurate enough, in that he'd stand out as an African-American in Israel, but his skills overcame any doubt I had about him being able to operate. He was one of the best I'd ever seen. I'd said, "Well, you weren't my first choice, but you know the push for diversity. I was only allowed one white boy, which meant me. With you and Jennifer, the team's a perfect example of what the world should be." He'd laughed and said, "What's our cover?" "Working it now." During the 12-hour flight, our cover story had been built, complete with official recognition from unwitting agencies within the United Nations. Ostensibly, we were going to make an assessment of the ongoing excavations at Caesarea, an ancient port just north of Tel Aviv, designated a World Heritage Site. Explorations had found extensive further archaeological structures still buried, and we were going to help facilitate the bureaucracy of the UN in the work, using Jennifer's arcane knowledge of everything that was as old as dirt. When we'd found out through the GoGo in-flight Wi-Fi, she'd literally clapped her hands. I told her not to get too excited. Chances were we would never set foot on the grounds. We'd landed, met the UN folks at the U.S. Embassy, and coordinated for future meetings, which was how all of that shit always worked. None of those people could ever simply say what was needed. It was always one meeting after another, with me wanting to punch the people in the room. Jennifer, of course, tried valiantly to tie us into a trip to the site, knowing we would have to go if we said we would. They had said, "Of course, but first we must determine the parameters of how you can help us decide what we're going to do next." Basically, they were saying, "Not so fast, we get paid by the day, let's drag this out a little bit." She'd been aggravated, but it gave us time to set our real mission in motion. For this one, we had the full backing of the Oversight Council, so we had all the tech and reach-back capability we needed. We knew the room the target was in and had reserved a room in the same hotel, the Hilton on the coast of Tel Aviv. What we didn't know was what the guy was up to, which was why I had been sent for the Alpha mission. To start unraveling that thread, I'd placed Brett in the lobby early, drinking coffee and waiting on the target or his Bulgarian thug to exit the elevator. 9. Jennifer dropped the robe, put on her bra, and began pulling on a pair of jeans. Innocently, as if she cared only about the mission, she said, "I think we should go to Caesarea if this doesn't pan out in the next few hours. I mean, we're supposedly getting paid by the United States to do that. We could leave Brett here." I laughed and said, "We're getting paid by the United States to figure out what that asshole is up to." She slid her arms into a blouse and said,
"Cover, Pike. We have to maintain our cover. We can't do anything over here without protection. You're the one who taught me that."
I said, okay, I get it. You want to go look at pottery shards? We'll do it, I promise." Jennifer's first love was archaeology, and she was perennially aggravated that our cover never let her actually see the sites we were supposedly supporting. She'd earned at least one trip to a site. She slid her feet into a pair of Salomon hikers and said,
"You promise? We don't do it today, and you know it's not happening."
I said, "Yeah, okay. After we flesh out what's going on, I'll take you there myself." She sighed and said,
"We're in the land of the Bible with more history per square mile than any place on earth, and I'm not going to see any of that, am I?"
"No, no, you will, I promise." Our computer dinged and she went to it. She took one look at the screen and said,
"Liar."
I ran to the computer and saw, "Pairs on the move. Just came to the lobby. They're getting coffee. Get your ass down here." I typed back, "On the way, stage the vehicles." Then looked at Jennifer with chagrin. I said, "Sorry, I can't predict this stuff." She threw her bag over her shoulder and said,
"Yeah, yeah, story of my life."
I said, "I really didn't plan this. Come on." She held the door open, a little wicked grin on her face, saying,
"Well, this just jacks it up another carrot."
Lately, she'd started keeping a tally of my perceived transgressions. The score was in the currency of precious stones. Didn't do the dishes on my turn? Making her wash a plate? That's an eighth of a carrot. Our mangy, diabolically evil cat taking a shit on the floor because I didn't change out the litter box? A quarter. Deploy for an archaeological site and not get to see it? A full carrot. I had no idea if she was kidding or not, and didn't want to even broach the fact that she was talking about a diamond. That had all sorts of subliminal connotations. I grabbed our backpack of tech gear, both of us racing out. We reached the lobby and saw our targets crossing it, each carrying a paper cup of coffee. We ignored them, heading straight to the revolving door exit. Getting outside, I saw Brett down the circular drive at a pullout, leaning on a vehicle. We got to him, and he tossed me a key fob, saying, "I'm getting reimbursed for the valet tip." I clicked the door locks and said, "Easy day. You take a car as Singleton. Jennifer and I have the other one. You got your earpiece running?" "Yeah." I clicked mine and said, "Test, test." I heard him next to me, then in my ear, "I got you." I said, "Okay, today's just exploratory. Let's see where they go, what they do. Get us an angle on what's going on. Remember, it might be nothing at all." Brett slid into the seat of his car and said, "Somehow you'll manage to turn nothing into high adventure." I grinned and said, "We can only hope. But remember, it's alpha only. The high adventure will come later, when we prove this guy's an asshole." I saw Tyler Malloy exit with his sidekick from Bulgaria and took a closer look at him. As much as I wanted it to be true, he was not a pussy. Dressed in 5'11 pants, a Columbia shirt, and a Mountain Hardware fleece jacket, he looked just like any other military contractor on the planet. But he was no longer a gunslinger, and had no reason to dress like one. He was now an international arms dealer, and the fact that he refused to dress the part in his new position told me volumes. He was about 6'2 and carried some weight, but not in a bad way. He hadn't left the Marines and dived into Mickey D's and Pop-Tarts. He'd clearly stayed in shape, and of course he maintained the operator beard, which I found ridiculous, because he was never an operator. But obviously, he thought he was. They entered a Crown Vic limo and passed us, and we picked up the follow, Brett leading. They went through the intersection at the main road of Hayarkon, passing by the British Embassy, and we hung with them a few cars back. They made no left or right turns, so the surveillance effort was pretty simple. Eventually, we entered Ramat Gan, a city suburb east of Tel Aviv. We wound around for a few minutes, the channelized nature of the roads giving me confidence that we wouldn't be tagged as following. Abruptly, the Crown Vic stopped outside of some mall area with four tall buildings jutting into the sky. Brett passed the drop-off, going deep and saying, "Diamond Exchange." I pulled up short with Jennifer and said, "What's that?" "Just what I said. It's the Israeli Diamond Exchange, and it's locked down tight." Jennifer had already been working her tablet and said,
"It's one of the biggest diamond exchanges in the world. It rivals Antwerp."
She poked and prodded her tablet a bit more, then said,
"It has some serious security. We aren't getting in there."
Shit. I watched the two exit and enter the front doors of the exchange. I waited a beat, then said, "Stage here. Let's see what happens." Within 2 minutes, I saw the target we called Ivan exit. He stood on the steps for a minute, then waved over the limo. Decision time. I said, "Got Ivan out front now. Blood, I want you to stay on the building. We're going to take the trailer and see where it leads us." Brett said, "Only if you quit using that call sign." Everyone in the task force had a call sign, and usually for something they did that wasn't stellar. I'd anointed him with the call sign Blood, and he despised it. I said, "No promises. Ivan's in the limo. We're rolling."
10. Tyler Malloy told the hired car to wait on them, then bounded up the stairs to the entrance of the Diamond Exchange, Stanko Petrov right behind him. He opened the door and said, "That fucker had better be down here to let us in." Stanko said, "He'd be a fool not to." Tyler moved into the foyer, seeing a security setup that looked like a cross between a top-secret skiff and a TSA airport screening. Metal detectors, thumbprint scanners, and 6-foot rotating turnstile doors made of bars. Out front was a long desk staffed by men behind bulletproof glass. They looked at him expectantly, and he was brought up short. He glanced around, seeing nobody in the foyer who wasn't engaged, then approached one of the windows. He said, "I'm supposed to meet a man named Eli Cohen. He works here." The guard said, "I'm sorry, sir. I have no way to contact him. There are hundreds of diamond merchants, and they arrange the visits. I just process the application through." Tyler cursed and turned away from the window. Stanko pulled his sleeve and pointed at a man coming through the metal turnstile. He was short, about 5'5", with a mop of gray hair and a drooping mustache. His head was on a swivel, looking left and right. Tyler locked eyes with him, and he came scurrying over.
"Tyler Malloy?"
"Yes." He stuck out his hand, saying, "I'm Eli Cohen. Sorry. I got held up. Let's get you inside so we can talk." He glanced at Stanko, then said, "Is he with you?"
"Yes."
Tyler did the introductions, explaining who Stanko was and where he was from. And Eli said,
"Nice to meet you, but you cannot come inside."
Tyler said, "Why not?"
"He's Bulgarian. I had no advance notice. He'll need a background check. And they won't do it while we wait. I'm sorry, but it's actually to our advantage."
"What do you mean?" He glanced at the security window, making sure they were out of earshot, then said,
"Our friends from South Africa are here. There's been a complication."
"What kind of complication?"
"There was someone watching the meeting, and he possibly heard what we were doing. He has a partner here. They came to take care of the problem."
"What the fuck, we're already compromised?"
"I don't want to talk out here. Just have your friend go meet them to see what they're up to. It would be better for all."
Tyler was about to tell the man to kiss his ass when Stanko touched his arm and said,
"I can do that. No harm in listening."
Meaning, don't throw this away because you're insulted. Tyler nodded, and Eli gave him an address to a restaurant in Jaffa, just south of Tel Aviv. Stanko left, and Tyler said, "Okay, get me into your office, because I definitely have some questions." Eli approached the security window, showed his badge, and said a few words in Hebrew. He turned to Tyler and said,
"Passport, please."
Tyler switched places with him and surrendered his passport. He answered a few questions, placed his thumb on a fingerprint capture device, then had his photo taken. 2 minutes later, he was given a new badge. Eli led him to the security checkpoint, where he basically repeated the procedure, emptying his pockets for X-ray, passing across his badge, and placing his thumb on a fingerprint reader. Tyler followed Eli through the metal detector, and the guard manning it pointed at his cell phone, saying, "No pictures." Tyler nodded, actually impressed at the security. Walking to the elevator, he said, "Is there some giant vault in this place, like Fort Knox?"
"No. Every company on the exchange has its own safe. The security is tight because at any given moment people are wandering around here with millions of dollars worth of diamonds."
2 men in yarmulkes came by, both pulling black rollerboard luggage. Eli pointed and said, Those two aren't dragging their clothes from a plane flight. The bags are full of diamonds. Crossing the foyer toward the elevators, he pointed to the left, toward a sunken open area full of desks, saying, "That's the trading floor. Rough stones on one side, polished on the other. Biggest exchange in the world. I thought Antwerp was bigger." "So they say. Either way, we're the most respected. Our word is our bond." The elevator closed, and they began to rise to the third floor. Tyler said, "If this is such a respected institution, why are you doing what you're doing?" Eli said, "Respect doesn't pay the bills." They exited the elevator and traveled down a sterile hallway, stopping at a simple metal office door. Eli unlocked it, and inside was a small, opulent showroom, complete with chandelier, oak walls lined with jewelry, cherrywood oval table, and Victorian chairs. In the back, past the showroom, were a couple of offices, one manned, one empty. Eli closed the doors and said, "The truth of the matter is that the Israeli Diamond Exchange is under assault from 1,000 different points. Child cutters in India, blood diamonds, wholesalers who have turned our business into a box store. And outsourcing to the Third World, it's becoming fragmented. Israel used to be the epicenter of the diamond world. It's not anymore. People who've worked the exchange for generations are getting out, and not because they want to. That's not going to happen to me." "What do you mean? How is the project in Lesotho going to help with that?" "Lesotho produces the largest gem-quality diamonds in the world. But De Beers owns all the mines. Currently, the government only owns 30% of the production, but they are opening 2 new mines, which will be owned by the Kingdom of Lesotho, not De Beers. And, if we succeed, that government will be amenable to me. No middleman, just me." Tyler nodded, now understanding the why of his business deal here. Ordinarily, he didn't care one way or the other what happened with his weapons, but this time he was betting on the come, providing his services without a concrete payout. So it was good to see the state of play. "So you put in Mikhailo Lanata as prime minister, and he repays you with favorable diamond concessions? Is that it?"
"Yes, in a nutshell. The current prime minister is no babe in the woods. He has enough corruption charges against him to sink the Titanic. He's just skilled in deflecting attention. We remove him, provide the evidence, and Lenatha, as the deputy prime minister, steps in. An easy coup.
What if General Masibo decides he'd rather be in charge? He's the one who controls the monopoly of violence. He's got the LDF Special Forces on his side, which is being charitable in the description of that unit.
He's on board, and those men are going to be the bulwark of the mission. All he wants is to remain as the head of the Lesotho Defense Force. The Prime Minister has demanded he retire, and he doesn't want to. Lenatha has told him that if he'll play ball, he can remain in charge of the LDF. That's all he wants. The Prime Minister was stupid to force the General's hand."
Tyler slowly nodded, then said, "What about the opposition party? The ones who stormed the streets last year?" Eli snapped his head to him, and Tyler said, "You didn't think I'd get involved without a little bit of research, did you? What about the do-gooder party that everyone loves? The one that everyone wants in power? What if they come into play? It won't be a bloodless coup. It'll be a bloodbath. Can you withstand that on the evening news?" Eli sat heavily in a chair and said,
"Masibo has taken care of their leader. They are no longer a force."
Tyler toyed with a necklace on the wall, his back to Eli. He said, "Taken care of him." Eli said,
"None of this is clean. Don't tell me you've grown a conscience."
Tyler turned around and said, "I'm just judging success, because whatever happens, I want to get paid. He bored his eyes into Eli and said, "And you've not given me a whit of confidence that you can do that." 11. Eli Cohen leaned back in his chair and waved an arm, saying, "You'll be paid. If not in what you want, I'll do it in cash." "I don't want cash. I can get cash anywhere with much, much less risk. I want the triggers. You said you could do that, and if you're telling me my alternative is a cash payment, I'm out. I can get them." "How? You've never said. Are they Israeli? Are you stealing them from here or what?" "No," Eli sighed, then said, "Okay, I'll tell you something I'd hope to keep hidden. Before I was a diamond merchant, before I followed in my father's footsteps, I was in Lechem. You know it?"
"No, never heard of it."
"We were the intelligence agency tasked with gleaning nuclear secrets for the Israeli nuclear weapons program. We traveled far and wide, stealing whatever industrial secrets we could to build our capability, sometimes by subterfuge, and other times with witting partners."
"The United States?"
"Maybe, maybe not. Anyway, when we were done, we helped South Africa with Project Circle, the development of their atomic bomb. We were successful. They built six of them. In 1989, with apartheid ripping the country apart, the president, de Klerk, gave them up. He dismantled them. The bombs no longer exist, but your triggers do."
"And how can you get them?"
"I told you I was Lichen. My contacts remain. I can get them. I promise.
I need the actual Krytron triggers, not some bullshit. I need the real deal."
"I understand." Eli turned his chair and faced Tyler head on. "I must ask, if you don't mind, who you intend to sell those triggers to. They are incredibly hard to manufacture, with tolerances that very few technologically sophisticated states can produce, which means you aren't selling them to the West. They could make their own."
"Don't worry about that. I have a buyer. I don't ask about your diamond crap. You don't ask about my sales."
"But you did ask about my diamond crap. Tell me it isn't Iran."
Tyler chuckled, then said, "It isn't Iran." Eli nodded, saying, "Good. There are steps I won't take." Tyler said, "Don't get your hopes up just yet. I haven't agreed to help. I still don't know what you want." Eli went to his office, came back, and passed a sheet of paper across the table. He said, "This is what they need." Tyler looked at the first line and said, "An aircraft with crew? Halo rigs? You want me to do more than just supply armament?"
"You said you could."
Tyler placed the paper on the desk and said, "Who are these guys?"
"It's a company called Pamwichete. The CEO is Colonel Lloyd Armstrong. He was a Rhodesian Selu scout. You've heard of them?"
Tyler nodded, saying, "Yeah, I've heard of them. Guys who used to penetrate denied areas acting as the enemy guerrillas during Rhodesia's civil war. Pure balls."
"Yes, that's correct. When Rhodesia fell, he joined the South African Defense Force and the reconnaissance commandos. He has extensive experience in this type of work. He's an expert."
Tyler nodded and said, "Okay, it sounds like you've got a force that isn't a clown fest. But what was the complication you mentioned earlier?" Eli rubbed his face, glanced out the window, then said,
"It appears we've been breached."
Tyler was floored. "Breached? What the fuck are you talking about?"
"There was a man in Soweto. He was following our team, and we captured him."
"And what did he say?" Tyler knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that the men who'd captured him
wouldn't be squeamish in the questioning, and the detainee would have talked. He held out for a long time, so long that the team feels he really didn't know anything. He had no knowledge of our operation and was apparently sent because of some shady dealings here in the diamond exchange.
You mean shady dealings with you?
Eli snapped upright and said, No, my name was never mentioned, ever.
Well, he was either following the contractors, or he was following your man. Since he was talking about the diamond exchange, it seems pretty simple why he was there.
It wasn't me, per se. He was there on some fishing expedition. We're not even sure he was from the Israeli government. I think it's some investigation that's much bigger than just my company. But we don't know for sure. We're not sure of anything except he has no knowledge of our coup.
So he's dead?
No. Johann, the man who captured him from our team, feels it's better to keep him alive. As leverage.
Leverage for what?
In case we're wrong.
Well, that's fucking great. You believe you've been compromised, so you're keeping him as a bargaining chip? Why the hell should I continue?
Eli grinned and said, Because you want the triggers.
Tyler pulled back a chair and finally sat down. He said, What's the team doing here? Who's Stanko meeting?
The man has a partner. She might raise an alarm if he doesn't contact her.
We believe she's his control. She is expendable.
He's only good as leverage as long as it's unknown he's captured. They're here to clean that up.
He's working for someone higher than just one partner. Someone's paying him. Eventually they'll know.
Yes, but not before we've accomplished our mission. We aren't keeping him for a month.
Tyler played with a pen on the desk, spinning it in his hands. He finally nodded, saying, Stanko is good at this sort of thing. He's the best at cutting leaks.
Eli smiled, relieved to have Tyler on board, thinking of the profits he would realize with his new diamond tenders.
He stood up and held out his hand. When Tyler shook it, he said,
Mazel ubracha.
Tyler let go, saying, What's that mean?
It's the traditional way of the diamond market. It means the deal is sealed, and I stake my honor on its completion.
Eli said it with pride, not giving a thought to the fact that much more than his honor was at stake. He would learn that soon. 12.
Pike pulled in behind the Crown Vic, two cars back, and said, Give me a read. What's he doing?
Looking at the tablet in her lap, a satellite feed of a moving map of Tel Aviv scrolling on the screen, Jennifer said,
He's definitely not going back to the hotel. He's headed south toward Jaffa.
Okay, that's good. He's got a mission.
Or he's going shopping in the flea market.
Pike turned off the primary highway, still three cars back, and began winding through the surface streets. He said, What flea market?
Jennifer looked up from her tablet and said, Do you really not do any mission prep before you travel?
Well, I packed the tech kit Creed gave me, and I dug out Shoshana and Aaron's phone numbers. Does that count?
No, it doesn't. Jaffa has a flea market that spans city blocks. People go there to shop?
Pike spun through another intersection and said, That fucker isn't shopping for souvenirs, trust me. What else is in Jaffa?
Chagrined, Jennifer said, You should really do some research before we fly.
I'll do it tonight. Give me a prediction.
She thought a moment, then said, He's either going to the port or he's going to the old city. He's meeting someone, and that someone isn't his demographic. He's trying to blend in, and he needs an area that has a hodgepodge of people where they're used to seeing a melting pot and the crowd will be eclectic. Somewhere he won't have to explain why he's there.
Why Jaffa and not Tel Aviv?
Tel Aviv is a city.
with all that implies. It's a 19th, 20th century construct, with areas spliced out like the Diamond District. Tel Aviv looks big, but the four square blocks you work in include everyone doing your business. Fashion District, Diamond District, Industrial Section. It's like every other city on Earth. Jaffa is different. It's one of the oldest ports in the world, if not the oldest. It's literally where Jonah put to sea in the Old Testament, before he was swallowed by the whale. Now it's full of art galleries and tourists. It's the place to do a meeting if you were getting together with someone unlike you. She saw Pike consider what she told him. He said, "Not bad, little Jedi." She said, "It's not rocket science, Rain Man. If you do your due diligence and mission prep, we wouldn't be having this conversation." He flicked his eyes to her and let a grin slip out. "That's why I have you." She grinned back and said, "Thank God for that." They hit a traffic circle with a clock tower on the far side, and Jennifer said, "This is the outskirts of the old fortress walls of Jaffa. If I'm right, he'll be getting out soon." The area was packed. The cars all slowed to 5 miles an hour, dodging the pedestrians. Pike said, "Shit, no parking around here. If he ditches, you're going foxtrot behind him." She packed the tablet and nodded, now into the mission. But not enough to keep her from educating Pike on a little history. They inched forward and she said, "See that building, the one with the bars?" "Yeah." "That's where they kept Eichmann after they captured him. And that facade over there, the one that looks like the front of a building with nothing behind it? That's where the Irgun blew up a car bomb fighting the British Mandate." Pike scrunched his eyes and said, "Jesus, how much reading did you do?" The Crown Vic pulled over, and Jennifer saw the passenger door open. She leaned in and kissed Pike on the cheek, saying, "Enough to know that Jesus wasn't ever here, and that I'd like to explore after this is done." He smiled and said, "Okay, okay, I get it. Don't lose him." She grinned and said, "Promises, promises." Then leapt out, hearing Pike say, "Make sure your phone beacon is on. I'll be there shortly." Following Ivan ended up being surprisingly easy, with the crowds from all over the world allowing her to blend in seamlessly. His choice of location helped her as much as him. He went straight past the clock tower, walking by the old city gate, and then cut in, headed to the port. He went uphill, entering a park full of tourists out to enjoy the brisk winter air, and she paused, texting Pike. "You find parking?" She saw the bubbles on her phone, then, "Yeah, on the way." She texted, "He's in a park, I have him, but if he meets in here, I can't get close." She received, "I see you on my phone. Stay on him." She darted across the street and entered the park behind him, the concrete paths winding upward. Ivan gave no indication he was doing anything other than heading to a destination, and he clearly knew the terrain. He'd been here before. He crossed over a bridge full of tourists, all touching a sign of the Zodiac, and gazing out to the ocean. She passed a placard proclaiming the Wishing Bridge and held back, letting him get to the other side. When he did, she darted across, wondering if she should slap her hands on the Virgo plate and throw out a plea for a successful mission. Or maybe a wish to explore this town when she wasn't carrying a weapon and following a killer. She saw the symbol of Virgo and almost stopped, but a passel of school kids was around it, all chattering. She kept going, thinking she probably could have used that chance to put a hex on Pike to get off his ass with their relationship. Where did that come from? The thought came to her completely unbidden. She banished it and jogged a bit to catch up with her target, focusing on the mission. Ivan left the park and entered the old city, an ancient citadel of stone that looked like something out of Robin Hood. It was peppered with small artisan shops selling jewelry and other things,
and Jennifer could smell the history and felt a longing to slow down to enjoy it. But that wouldn't happen on this day. Ivan began winding through the narrow alleys, skipping down the steps two at a time, and glancing at his watch. He's late, which would make her surveillance harder, because one person moving fast was normal. Two, spaced apart, was definitely something people would notice. She lost him at the bottom of a curving line of stairs and sprinted to catch up, spilling out onto a promenade of the ancient port of Jaffa, fishermen still working their trade like they had for a millennium. She pulled up short and glanced left and right, seeing tourists from the world over enjoying the setting. Damn it! She had to make a choice, left or right. She decided left, toward the old port warehouses that now held restaurants and shops. Right was nothing but the promenade, and would be looping back the way he'd come. She moved at a rapid clip, scanning each cafe and shop. She had almost reached the end and was about to turn around when she caught her target talking to a hostess. She glanced at the sign outside the restaurant, "The Old Man and the Sea." She pulled up short, turning to the port, and allowing him to enter. The restaurant had an outdoor area that was enclosed in plastic to protect against the winter weather. Inside, she could see a bustling enclave full of tourists. Perfect. She watched the hostess lead him inside, going right. Jennifer texted Pike her location, then approached when the hostess returned. Table for two? My husband is late, but I'd like to get out of the wind now, if that's okay. The hostess smiled and said, "So you don't want to sit outside, I take it?" She pointed toward the right, saying, "No, I think that little nook over there would be perfect." 13. Sitting at a small four-top table crammed into what looked originally to be a tool storage area in the age of sails, Jennifer placed her back to the rough wall and inventoried the target table. Including Ivan, there were five men, all Caucasian. When he'd approached, the four had stood up and introduced themselves, so she knew it was an initial meeting. Ivan was dressed in slacks and a jacket, looking like a businessman. The four he met looked more like adventure travelers, with loose-fitting shirts, cargo pants, and hiking boots. Given Ivan's position in Parabellum, she was sure they were military contractors. But from where? And why were they here in Israel? Was Tyler brokering a deal with the Israelis for some type of armament? If so, why was Ivan just now meeting them? If they were here at the behest of Parabellum, wouldn't he have brought known employees? And the biggest question, what did the diamond exchange have to do with anything? She was brought out of her thoughts by Pike sliding onto the bench next to her, breathing slightly heavily. She said, "Need some more gym time?" He said, "I went the wrong way down one of those damn alleys. I had to make up ground. That place is a maze, and dead reckoning using your GPS beacon wasn't the best idea." He pulled his knapsack to his lap and opened it, saying, "What do we have?" She told him what she knew, and he said, "Penetration options?" "Haven't seen anything specific, but I'm sure they all have phones." She watched him pull out what looked like a typical smartphone, but with a small antenna jutting out of the side. He booted up the device, saw a myriad of different apps, then set it on the table. He began dialing his real smartphone, saying, "Creed's going to have to walk me through this. I'll waste the entire meeting trying to get it to work." She stopped him and said, "Let me talk to Creed. You scare him." He passed across his phone with a grin, saying, "You mean he has a crush on you?" Bartholomew Creedwater was a computer network operations guy, which, like saying a loan shark was an alternative financing expert, was a polite title for what he really did.
He was a hacker, and he was good at his trade. He'd worked with their team on a number of occasions,